WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives. One moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. It's hard to imagine anything more painful to a parent than the death of their child. Confronting such a loss is the central focus of a new novel from Russell Banks called The Sweet Hereafter. It's a story about what happens in a small community following a tragic school bus accident in which 14 children are killed. Banks says he wanted to deal with the aftermath of such a calamity more than the catastrophe itself. Russell Banks comes from Barnstead, New Hampshire, a small New England town similar to the one that provides the backdrop to The Sweet Hereafter. His previous novels include Affliction and Continental Drift. The story of the school bus accident is told through four different points of view, from the father of two of the kids who were killed, a negligence attorney from New York, and a teenage girl who survived the accident. The book begins with an account of the accident, as recalled by Dolores Driscoll, the driver of the bus, who's trying to remember how she lost control.
A dog. It was a dog I saw for certain, or thought I saw. It was snowing pretty hard by then, and you can see things in the snow that aren't there, or aren't exactly there. But you also can't see some of the things that are there, so that, by God, when you do see something, you react anyhow, erring on the distaff side, if you get my drift. That's my training as a driver, but it's also my temperament as a mother of two grown sons and wife to an invalid. And that way, when I'm wrong, at least I'm wrong on the side of the angels. It was like the ghost of a dog I saw, a reddish-brown blur much smaller than a deer, which is what you'd expect to see out there that early, although the same gingerbread color as a deer it was, moving fast behind the cloud of snow falling between us, then slow, and then stopped altogether in the middle of the road like it was trying to make up its mind whether to go on or go back. I couldn't see it clearly, so can't say what it was for sure, but I saw the blur clearly. That's what I mean to say, and that's what I reacted to. These things have to happen faster than you can think about them, because if they don't, you're going to be locked in place just like that dog or deer or whatever the hell it was, and you'll get smacked head-on the same as that dog would have if I hadn't hit the brake and pulled the wheel without thinking. But there's no point now to lingering over the dog, whether it was a dog or a tiny deer or even an optical illusion, which, to be absolutely truthful, now seems likeliest. All that matters is that I saw something I didn't expect out there and didn't particularly identify at the time, there being no time for that. So let's just say it was like a dog, one of those small red spaniels, smaller than a setter, the size of a kid in a rust-colored snowsuit. And I did what anyone with half a brain would have done. I tried to avoid hitting it.
Where did this idea of a small town dealing with a school bus accident in which many of the town's children die, where did that idea come from?
God only knows where your sources really come from, but I am conscious of having read and being struck by an article, in fact, a series of articles in 1989 and 90, early 90, concerning a small town, a Hispanic community in South Texas. You might remember the case where a school bus was nudged off the road by a Coke truck into a quarry, and a number of children were killed and so forth. But the articles that left me puzzled and saddened and, I guess, engaged were about the townspeople in South Texas town, where everybody ended up suing each other, countersuits were filed, people were ostracized. There was a kind of self-destructive operation going on following that accident. And I think, in a way, grieved over that at long range. And I couldn't write about a story about South Texas Hispanic community very well, but I lived 6 months a year in upstate New York in the Adirondacks, and I know those people and grew up amongst people like that. So it wasn't too hard for me to translate over.
As a parent, can you contemplate anything more painful than losing a child when they're still young?
Well, no, that's... in fact, I probably couldn't have written... I have four children, and... four daughters now grown. The youngest is 20. And I probably couldn't have written this book until recently, really, until I kind of stopped waking up in the middle of the night with those kind of cold sweats that a parent gets when you you realize, my God, the terrible fragility of life, and especially of your child's life, and the terrible responsibility that you have for preserving that and protecting that. And you sort of superstitiously name the thing you're most frightened of, I suppose, and hoping that it'll go away if you can name it. And that might have been a motive, a deeper, more profound motive, personal motive for me to in the writing of the book, was now I was free enough to name the thing I've been most frightened of for 25 years, and I could encounter it this way without coming undone.
This seems like an unfair question to ask you, but I know that Sigmund Freud says that behind a fear is a wish. Can you contemplate that?
That's a hard one. You really threw a curveball at me with that.
I don't even know if I believe.
Yeah. Well, what would be my wish in this case? I suppose there may be indeed, but behind the fear of the loss of your child is the wish for the loss of your child. Not that your child should die, but that you should be free of your child and free of this terrible responsibility that the child's existence places on you. And sure, there may be a bit of that as well operating. And so we bring to these occasions, some turbulent and powerful emotions, I think.
Do you think there's something about accidents or tragedies that create a kind of vividness of memory? As we meet your characters, mm-hmm. They remember the details mm-hmm. of the day, everything mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. they did, mm-hmm. Remembering it as if they are, in a sense, reliving it.
Yeah, when I was first researching the book, really, and trying to understand how I was going to get it, I knew I wanted to have it told in the first person by four different characters, picking up one after the other and continuing the story. But I wanted to find a kind of language which would be appropriate for this situation and for these people. And I have a friend who's a negligence lawyer, and Mitchell Stevens Esquire is not based on my friend, I hasten to add.
Lucky for him.
Lucky for me. But he provided me with some transcripts of depositions taken by parents who were bringing negligence suits, parents who had lost their children. And I was... overpowered, really, by a couple of things, in particular by the precision, the care for the exact truth as they remember or understood it, and the details of the child's existence and daily reality and so forth. The absence of generalization. Everything seems incredibly concrete. On the one hand. And then on the other hand, there was a flatness of affect. Tonally, it was impersonal and flat. And the combination of the flatness and the precision of detail created a kind of rhetoric that I tried to use as a model for my own style in this book, the language that I wanted to get at, and still make them distinct voices.
Russell Banks is my guest, and his latest book is called The Sweet Hereafter, and it's a novel, a story of a town in upstate New York that loses its children in a bus accident, and it's a story told through the eyes of several of the people who live in the town and who try to come to terms with this tragedy. One of your characters says, a town that loses its children loses its meaning. Does a town, this town called Sam Dent, New York, how does it need its children? How does a town need its children?
Well, it reaffirms, I suppose, the natural order of things. There's a kind of agreement made with the birth of a child in a family and in a town and in a country, in a nation, really, that the child will outlive the parent. There's a natural order of things. Death comes it comes inevitably, but it comes at the right time. And when it doesn't come at the right time, then it loses meaning. I mean, then life loses meaning. That disruption of the natural order. And I think that's what Billy Ansel, the character, was referring to there, is that loss of the natural order of things.
You grew up in a small town in New Hampshire,
right.
Barnstead, New Hampshire.
Yeah, how'd you know?
Banstead is what they say out there.
Right.
When you were young, did you feel your town needed you, as you have this character saying?
That's an interesting question. It's hard to say. I just had a funny experience. I don't know. This is maybe just a digression, but I went back and read at the town library where I went to high school, and about 40 or 50 of my classmates were there, and old high school teachers were there. And it was a public reading, and at a certain point in the Q&A period at the end, you know, where you usually get the serious literary questions, there, a woman stood up, an elderly woman in the back of the room, and she, I didn't know who she was. She said, "Russell, how's your mother?" It was one of those wonderful moments. I mean, it was like a plant. I wanted to take her around all over the country and put her in every audience for every Q&A. It just relaxed me. It relaxed the audience. Everybody laughed. And then we got a bunch of real questions, too. I mean, but I got to talk about my mother with her, which was nice.
So how is your mother?
She's fine.
Yeah. The digression, it is a digression, yeah, but it also, I think, really
yeah, I wanted to show talks that, about... That connection was so comforting, you know, when she asked that personal, friendly, she knows I have a mother and she worried about her. She said, "I knew her in scouting," which meant I think they were scout mothers or something, yeah. And that made me at ease and feel like I had come home. Up to that moment, I hadn't felt quite that easy and secure.
Russell Banks is my guest, and his latest book is called The Sweet Hereafter, and it's the story of a small New York town's attempt to understand a tragic school bus accident in which a number of the town's children are killed. We're going to take a short break, and this is Fresh Air. Writer Russell Banks is my guest. I know a little bit about your life, and I know that your father was an alcoholic. He abandoned the family. He was abusive to you. Did your town protect you from him?
No, I can't say that they did, but I can't say that they had an opportunity to either, as most cases of this sort, domestic violence is a shameful secret that's withheld from the town. In the novel, in The Sweet Hereafter, there's a story that concerns the young girl, Nicole Burnell. I mean, the case of sexual abuse, and it's the family's secret, and she can't. I tried to show how she couldn't betray the family publicly without doing a shameful thing and just sort of destroying that family. How could she maintain the family and still not humiliate herself? And she manages to find a way of acting out of her anger, of bringing her anger against her father to bear on her father's life in a way that only he and she know. And that was important for me to work that through, to see how far I could go with that so that she could both be courageous and angry and could express that anger without destroying the unit to which she belonged and depended on so strongly, the family.
Were you actually able to do that in person, or did you have these characters
do that? No, I don't think I personally was able to do that at the time. I think most people are not. I didn't have enough wit, imagination, or perhaps circumstances where I could do it. The characters, yes, they probably do act in some ways as projections for us and live out some of our own needs and fantasies as well. But you don't know it at the time. I mean, when you look at it, I'm looking at it now a year later and looking back and saying, gee whiz, that's an interesting solution to her problem.
Wish I had thought of that.
Yeah, wish I had thought of that exactly.
Your relationship with your father, I think many people who have been in abusive relationships, whether it's physically or sexually, what a child gets is a lot of attention.
Oh, yeah.
Lot of focus of this parent is on this child. Yeah. They are inflicting pain on them, but they are in a sense, part of a center of someone's life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a great deal
Did you have
to
come to terms with that? And
I'm sure, yeah. I mean, I didn't ever go through a kind of psychoanalysis in order to deal with this myself. But so as a result, I probably spent many more years working through in small increments the aspects of this experience. And so I don't have, as a result, probably a very clear and coherent picture of how it occurred, because it happened in such small increments over so many years. But But I know there is a kind of heat and light at the center of that kind of oppression or exploitation that creates in the child and later perhaps even in the adult. Well, certainly not perhaps, certainly in the adult, a bewildering kind of guilt for the pleasure that you took and being the center of the attention and being so dramatically utilized, really.
One of the things that your book seems to want to do is, or at least want to explain, is this urge to affix blame or affix cause and blame to somehow, in the face of tragedy, to try to put it into some meaningful context. Do you think that's almost a human need? Or is that something? Is there something almost very American about that?
Yeah, I think in a secular age and an age which believes so profoundly in cause and effect, it's shocking and disorienting to us when something comes along that seems to be a causeless event. We have no religious apparatus for dealing with that. We have no social or scientific way of dealing with that. And so it makes us feel a little mad, really. And I think so the need to affix blame is very powerful in that context.
Writer Russell Banks is my guest. You've done many things besides writing.
Yeah.
When did you start to write? Were you avoiding it? Or did you even know
No, I think that I was not able early on to realize that it was a possibility for me that you could actually make a life out of this this silly thing of telling stories. Imagine that.
Was it a silly thing?
Well, it occasionally feels like that to me. Every now and then, something useful like pipe fitting. Every now and then I realize that, my God, I'm spending my life making up stories about people who don't exist and telling them to other people that I never meet. This is a rather peculiar way to live a life. Not by any means am I complaining, you understand. But to get back to your question, I did start writing more or less as a form of play and whimsy, just fantasy, really, when I was in my late teens and early 20s. I had thought at that time that I wanted to be a visual artist because I had a sort of a visible talent. I mean, it showed itself, and I could draw well. The hand could work. Eye-hand coordination wasn't bad when you put a pencil in it and put it on a page. But a literary gift isn't always that evident, and rarely that evident. So it was in my early 30s that I began to move from play to taking it fairly seriously and seeing what the possibilities were. And I think that had everything to do with that was the period in which I began to become a disciplined and a serious, even obsessive reader. So my involvement with reading really was what I think generated my sense of myself as a writer and made that possible for me.
You're the first in your family, I think, to go to college. Did your parents, did they have sort of aspirations for you of doing what they had not been able to do for themselves?
I think
themselves?
My mother certainly did. Although she had no clear idea of how or what was possible, I know that I never felt that she felt I was in any way betraying her or abandoning her in that regard. Whereas I think my father, but on the other hand, this was the figure in the family I most identified with. My father regarded it any ambitions other than to live a life exactly like his as a challenge, and I think he was defensive about that. Which is not unusual, really, that kind of response, because it is, in a sense, it's a rejection. You're rejecting the model. You know, the father has done what he can, and he puts forward himself as a model, and then you say, no, that's not good enough. I want to do something else, something different. And I'm sure, I mean, as a parent, I can imagine how that feels. And my children, I'm sure, in different ways have said the same thing. No, that's not good enough. I want to do something else.
This is a personal question, but you were cross-eyed as a child, or you had an eye that was crossed as a child?
Does it show?
Well, I find
myself... It wanders a little.
No, I find myself looking at one of your eyes and
yeah,
not the other. Yeah,
yeah. There, it's hard to look at both at once. Yeah. Yeah, because one is cast, yeah. Yeah.
Can you see out of your other eye? Or?
Oh, I can see fine, yeah. Yeah, just wanders around a little bit.
Was that something that you were uncomfortable about as a kid? I mean, were you self-conscious?
Self-conscious. Oh, sure. Yeah, I think so. Because it was much worse when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. I can see from pictures that it was quite clear, at least clear to me. Yeah. And and it was occasional. You know, children are very quick to find the object that they can tease and a little access to power there. And so I'm sure, you know, it was seen much greater to me at the time than it should have or could have.
Were you born that way?
I don't know. I don't think so. And my mother says that I acquired it in the first year of my life, her explanation for it is vague, and so I really don't know.
What do you think? I mean, what are your fantasies about it?
Oh, that an angel kissed me. I know where you're trying to lead me, and I'm not going there.
Are you working on another book now? Is that
yeah.
Once you're done, then you're sort of ready for it?
No, I've been off this book for a year, and it takes a year between completion and publication, so that's the year where you try to resubmerge yourself and get on with another book so that when a book comes out, you're busy and you're fixed on this other one, and you aren't so dependent on how the public responds to this one. It frees me from the reviewers in a way. I mean, John Cheever, when a book came out, used to go to Europe and stay there for about 6 weeks and wouldn't come back until nobody was speaking about the book anymore. I understand the impulse. I just bury myself in another book, and I am writing a novel now. It's going to be I assume at this point a long novel about, it's a historical novel based on the life of John Brown, the abolitionist, whose body lies moldering about 3 or 4 miles from where I live in New York. He's upstate New York. He was buried in the Adirondacks.
And, you feel his ghost?
You
somehow?
Sure can. When the moon comes up over Mount Marcy, you can feel the ghost of John Brown, restless.
Russell Banks, thank you very much for joining us today.
Well, thank you.
Russell Banks' latest book is called The Sweet Hereafter. I'm Marty Moscowain, and this is Fresh Air.